Support comes from St. Louis Public Library Foundation, helping the library serve children and their families with programs and services needed to become lifelong readers. More information about the foundation is at slpl.org.
This is St. Louis on the Air from St. Louis Public Radio. I'm Elaine Cha. 2024 was a big year for women's sports. But for women's basketball, big is an understatement. Records for viewership of the NCAA Division I tournament in March and the WNBA draft not only broke records, it shattered them. Case in point, an estimated 18.9 million people tuned in for the Women's March Madness final, and the WNBA draft drew 2.4 million viewers. With numbers like that, we've got a lot of people very excited about prospects for women's basketball, and given St. Louis's reputation for being a sports town, it's probably no surprise that high-profile, high-dollar baller Jayson Tatum, who is a St. Louis native and star Boston Celtics forward, is among a group of billionaire investors pushing to bring a WNBA franchise to St. Louis. Noah Cohan, is Assistant Director of American Culture Studies at Washington University, and he joins us today to talk about efforts to make St. Louis the future home of a WNBA team, number 16. Noah, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me. I'm so glad to talk hoops on any occasion.
Sure. So let's begin with the newsy part of this. Now, when you heard the news that the WNBA is looking to form a 16th team and that St. Louis might be considered for it, what first ran through your head and who did you talk to first?
I was thrilled. I'm a St. Louisan and a big WNBA fan. And so, it couldn't have been happier news for me to hear. I talked to some of my friends who are basketball fans, as well as my wife, who's a big women's sports fan. Mm-hmm. It's a really interesting thing that for this 16th team, they're sort of opening the bidding in this public way and taking bids, because for teams 13, 14, and 15, it sort of happened behind a curtain. It was just announced when the franchise was handed over that those cities were getting a team. So for this 16th team, they went about it a very different way. And that's a real opportunity for a place like St. Louis that may not ultimately end up getting the team, mm-hmm. but for the city and for the backers locally who want to own a team to be able to put it out in public that they're trying, I think is a good thing for St. Louis, regardless of the final outcome.
And what do you think was behind sort of drawing that curtain back or tearing it down?
I think just the surge in popularity, right? And a competitive public process also drives up the bidding, and the expansion fees are soaring. Mm-hmm. Portland's 15th team went for reportedly $150 million, and the expectations are that this 16th team will go for north of $200 million to whoever puts forward the cash and wins the bid.
Mm-hmm. Now, we mentioned Jayson Tatum in the introduction, and he's a kind of hometown hero because of his accomplishments in men's professional basketball. He's an NBA forward for the Boston Celtics and a standout player there and part of the Team USA Olympic team. So his investing in bringing the WNBA to St. Louis is kind of a big deal. But he's not the only player, so to speak, in this. There's a coalition behind this push. What is it that stands out to you about this coalition, and who are the two big names involved?
Well, there are two local business titans sort of backing the bid, Chaffetz of Chaffetz Arena, mm-hmm. and Hoffman, who's also a local billionaire who owns, I believe, one of the Blues minor league hockey teams, are the two biggest backers behind it. But adding athlete names to a bid is sort of common practice now across the country. So a bid that the St. Louis bid will be competing against, the one in Kansas City, has Patrick Mahomes, the Chiefs quarterback, mm-hmm. very publicly involved. And so this is something that ownership groups do in lots of different contexts to try to get fans excited and sympathetic toward their efforts, because a local billionaire doesn't excite the fans about the prospect of what they're up to the same way, you know, Jayson Tatum does. So mm-hmm. that's why his name is attached. I don't mean to diminish his real excitement for it.
Sure.
I think especially professional men's athletes in the four major sports see how profitable their leagues are, and they want to be on the ownership side of that equation because they make a lot of money, but they don't make as much as the billionaire owners do. And so the lower relative valuation of women's sports to their minds presents an opportunity to put themselves in that ownership class as opposed to just being the labor.
Mm-hmm. We'd like to invite you to this conversation as well. Do you watch women's basketball? Perhaps you've become a fan of women's basketball recently. Would you like to see St. Louis with a WNBA team? Call us at 314-382-8255. That's 314-382-TALK. Or send us an email at talk@stlpr.org. So you were very excited to hear about the prospect of a team coming here, WNBA, and you talked with your friends. So there's the dream, and then there is reality. So St. Louis basketball, if we look at history, it does have a rich and vibrant history, and it's deeply intertwined with the culture of the city. How much does that matter when it comes to decisions like the ones we're talking about today?
It matters tremendously. And unfortunately for St. Louis, its history at the top level of men's and women's leagues dies out by the early 1980s. We have, as recently as a couple of years ago, had a sort of mid-level or semi-professional women's pro team in St. Louis, the St. Louis Surge, backed by a local businesswoman named Kalia Collier, who now works as a vice president for the Dallas Mavericks. Mm-hmm. But obviously that team wasn't playing on the level of the WNBA. So before that, to get to top level basketball, men's or women's, in St. Louis, you have to go to the late 1970s and early 1980s when there was a St. Louis team in what was called the Women's Professional Basketball League, or WBL. They were called the St. Louis Streak. They played for two seasons, and then they folded when the entire league folded in 1981. Mm-hmm. On the men's side, the last top-level team was not an NBA team, but an ABA team, the Spirits of St. Louis, which played in St. Louis for two seasons from 1974 to 1976. And before that, the last NBA team, the Hawks, left in 1969. So we have a rich history. There's a lot more I could go into with those teams and the degree to which they were popular, the racial politics of their performance and reception by St. Louis. But the fact of the matter is, whatever nuance you go into, it's just been a long dry spell. So there will be an extra burden on the organizers of the St. Louis bid to show the WNBA that this is a basketball town. Mm-hmm. I firmly believe that it is, but there's not that sort of public evidence for it, apart from a couple of NCAA tournament championships that we hosted here, Division I, I should clarify, the men's in 2005 and the women's in 2001 and 2009.
Mm-hmm. I think something to acknowledge here, we talk about the NBA like it's always been around, but that is not true. How long did it take for the NBA not just to be something that people like to watch, maybe go to games, but for it to become profitable in the way that would make it worth it for investors and for people who are, you know, part of a city or a place that has a team, for them also to feel like it's worth it?
It took a very long time. And, you know, the NBA, as you sort of just alluded to, is the youngest of the four major professional sports leagues, and sort of was born from hockey owners' desires to fill their arena with extra dates. So these hockey owners, mostly in the Northeast, wanted to have more performances in their spaces to make more money. And so they founded one of the two leagues that eventually merged to become the NBA. So wasn't until the late 1940s that the NBA became the NBA, and then it wasn't until the 1980s that the profitability of the league really took off. Mm-hmm. Mostly, the early owners of NBA teams loved basketball and wanted to do something for their city. They weren't in it to make a lot of money. It's not until Bird and Magic and then Michael Jordan come along that NBA franchises become these economic powerhouses, at least for their ownership groups.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of Bird and Johnson, there's some star power that is associated with women's basketball in the past couple years. You know, WNBA seems to be having a moment. And there are two superstar players, Caitlin Clark and Angel Reese, who are largely credited for this increase in interest. And there being sort of a rivalry maybe between the two. And I don't think it's any coincidence that these two athletes also were in the limelight around college basketball. I mean, how much of that kind of star power among athletes do you think will help a team that would come to St. Louis actually sustain over time?
Yeah, I think the dynamic that Clark and Reese bring is super important. But I want to just table that for just a moment to point out that since the WNBA's inception in the 1990s, it has been a star-driven league. The league was born from excitement over the 1996 Atlanta Olympics and all of the star players that had made a name in NCAA basketball sort of being together on one team, and the U.S. for the first time really dominating the sport. And they haven't lost a game in the Olympics since then. So there's long been a lot of star power involved in the WNBA, I should say. And I think there was an upward trend really happening before Clark and Reese sort of hit the league. Mm-hmm. But it's undeniable that they have just shot things to the stratosphere, where this expansion cycle has been accelerated so much. We were on track for WNBA expansion before they entered the league. But to add four teams as quickly as they're doing, they're clearly trying to capitalize on the moment. Mm-hmm. And as to the particulars of Reese and Clark, I think like Bird and Johnson, there's definitely a race aspect to it. Clark being a dynamic scorer and a white player, much like Larry Bird, and Reese being having a lot of flair and excitement and energy, and being a black player like Magic Johnson. So there's no doubt, though the WNBA is never going to point this out, that part of what made a lot of people want to pay attention to the times that they clashed on opposite teams in college and the times that they play against each other in the pros has to do with a racialized dynamic of basketball. And I think that that also is something that we can see locally with the way basketball has been received or not received over time, that basketball's association with black culture, both at the highest level and at the recreational level, has led some viewers to sort of want to tune out. And fair or not, St. Louis's reputation as a basketball town has been negatively impacted by what people think of as a kind of anti-black racism among a lot of St. Louis sports fans.
Sure. If you're just tuning in, we're talking with Noah Cohan, who is Assistant Director of American Culture Studies at Washington University, and we're discussing prospects for St. Louis's getting a WNBA team in the next several years. We'd also like to invite you to the conversation. What do you make of St. Louis's basketball culture and of our region's history with the sport? Give us a call at 314-382-8255. That's 382-TALK, or email us at talk@stlpr.org. So if we were to get a team, what would be the measures of success for that team, Noah?
Well, I think the plan would be for them to play at Chaffetz Arena, SLU's arena. It's about a 10,000-seat arena, which is about right for WNBA teams. A lot of WNBA teams play in similarly sized facilities and are able to do quite well in selling tickets at that size. Some of them have taken to moving to larger arenas when Caitlin Clark comes to town because there's such a surge in popularity and ticket sales, but mostly they're around that size. So that would seem to be a facility that would work well for the WNBA. I think a big thing that the ownership group might have to prove to the WNBA in putting together this bid is that they have adequate designated space for the team in terms of a practice facility and administrative offices.
Why is that important?
Well, the WNBA's collective bargaining agreement, until it was recently, they recently opted out, the players did, because they want to go negotiate a new one, and rightly so, because with the new media rights deal, they should make a lot more money than they have been. But because of the history of the collective bargaining agreements that they've signed, their salaries have been relatively suppressed, and the top-level talent has been not able to make, I think at the max, around $250,000. So the teams are relatively on even footing in terms of recruiting free agents to come to their teams because they all are limited very severely by the top level salary that they can play. So one way to attract free agents is to have really dynamic, exciting facilities. So the Seattle Storm, for example, built a designated practice facility just for their team. And that's not just gyms. It's also, you know, physical training, amenities, mm-hmm. massage areas, all kinds of different things for the players to go. Because the practice facility is where you go on a daily basis.
Right,
you
right.
only go to the arena on game day. Mm-hmm. So to be able to put together a first-class practice facility is something that a lot of WNBA teams have recognized as a really important enticement for free agents. And I think if St. Louis is going to win the bid, they would have to blow away the league with what they're planning to do in terms of facilities for the team. So it's less about the arena. I think Shea Fitz would be fine, and
sure.
more about having those facilities for the team.
What was the price tag for that Seattle practice facility?
I don't know. I think it was in the tens of millions of dollars, but nothing like, you know, a stadium can be upwards of $1 billion or $2 billion,
mm-hmm.
you know, depending on what it's got. So it's not expensive on those terms, but it's still an outlay for ownership groups.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything else St. Louis would need to, you know, either do or have to ensure success once a team has been started here?
I mean, demonstrating that there is a dedicated group of fans that would, you know, show up for this team. I think a good sign might be that City SC has done so well. I mean, they've clearly shown that it's not just baseball and hockey fans in
right.
this town, that we've got folks who are interested in other sports, and it's not, you know, those aren't the same fans necessarily. You know, they might be also be fans of those teams, but there are also dedicated soccer fans in this town.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the WNBA team prospective team showing that they have that dedicated fan base in St. Louis would be important to do. I don't know how exactly they would do that, but demonstrating the sort of culture of your city that will support this team is going to be an important thing that the winning bidder demonstrates.
Mm-hmm. We have Susan, who is calling from Illinois. Susan, welcome to St. Louis on the Air.
Well, good morning.
Good morning.
Good noon.
yes, that's right.
Yes, I'm in favor of it. I feel affirmed and reaffirmed when I hear about women's great basketball. And I had a woman policeman a couple days ago, and it was so helpful. It's just great to see women participating.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any connections specifically, Susan, to basketball as a, you know, a former player? Is there someone in your family who plays?
Well, basketball was big at our high school, Edwardsville High School,
mm-hmm.
but it's been big for a long time. That's men's basketball. In GAA, we had some basketball. It wasn't organized exactly the same way. It wasn't played the same way. Well, I happen to be a swim coach.
Oh, I see.
But,
okay.
It's very exciting, yeah, to see women participating in sports.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Susan. So, Noah, I mean, this discussion of bringing a WNBA team to St. Louis, what does it do to advance, you know, other efforts associated, you know, with sports? Does it give it a boost? Like, Susan is a swim coach, so she's thinking about it sort of from the perspective of somebody who is very deeply involved with another form of athletics. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's just basketball that's having a moment. The NWSL is very successful, and our sister Missouri City in Kansas City has its own, the first team in the league with a dedicated stadium just for their team. The current that league is thriving and expanding as well. I don't think it's all just because of some new enlightenment among the American sporting populace. I think a lot of it has to do with TV networks and the sort of sports ownership class realizing that the women's game is, there's the potential for a lot of profits there too.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're willing and eager to expand. Whatever the reason, I think it is an important moment. And it's not just about excitement for the future or the possibility that a team coming to a place like St. Louis could bring new energy. It's also about calling attention to the women who have come before, because the history of women playing basketball is not especially well known. Basketball is invented in 1893 by Dr. James Naismith for men, but it's within the first year that it's adopted for women by Senda Berenson, who was a physical education teacher at Smith College in Massachusetts. And women have been playing basketball, unlike football or baseball or a lot of different sports, women have been playing basketball since the beginning. Mm-hmm. And St. Louis's history is part of that. In 1904, for the World's Fair, a team of young women from the Fort Shaw Indian School in Fort Shaw, Montana, came to the World's Fair to perform their basketball talents and really blew away all the spectators at the fair. They were awarded a silver trophy as world's champions. They were undefeated in their time in St. Louis. They played against some local high schools. They played against each other. It was really a triumphant moment for those women within the context, we should say, of a really racist World's Fair. I mean, the Indian School itself was a sort of horrific federal institution that aimed to kill the Indian, save the man, right? So they were trying to strip away the culture of these indigenous people. So basketball being part of that is not a good thing. But I think there is undeniably something to be said for the embodied joy that these women clearly exhibited in playing basketball, having control of their own bodies, being to play this sport at a high level. And so St. Louis's history, rich history with basketball, goes back to that period. Mm-hmm. I already mentioned the professional team we had in the 1980s. There also is a rich history of prep players from St. Louis going on to great things. Kristen Fokel, who I used to work with at the St. Louis Sports Commission, she played at St. Joe High School and was an Olympian in volleyball, but also played varsity basketball at Stanford and went on to play in the WNBA for, I believe, 4 years. And more recently, those of us who are big WNBA fans and were watching the WNBA finals, Nafisa Collier from Incarnate Word High School, mm-hmm. in right here in the St. Louis region, was the best player in those finals, and had a questionable call not been made at the end of Game 5, she would have been the MVP of that series. So St. Louis's women's basketball history is much richer than people think. And I hope, I'm sure they are digging into this history as well, but I hope the ownership group does due diligence to emphasize that history in making mm-hmm. the bid.
You spoke earlier, Noah, about the role that race has played in who plays basketball, who doesn't, where it's played and where it is not played. And you're the co-creator of Whereas Hoops, and that's a multimedia work of scholarship and activism that has worked to get basketball hoops installed at St. Louis's Forest Park. And we've actually talked about that here on this show. Given sort of the entirety of the conversation we've had, and thinking about infrastructure not only in terms of where a prospective WNBA team would play, how has it been for you to see the fruition of your efforts to get public courts installed here in St. Louis?
Basketball is a beautiful game. Soccer claims that particular phrasing, but I like to ascribe it to basketball as well. And it's for everyone. You know, people of all races, genders, sexual orientations, whatever kind of human being you are, all matters of ability. You know, mm-hmm. you can play wheelchair basketball, all kinds of different basketball. Whatever your personality or personhood is like, basketball is for you. The problem comes in the way that, especially at the highest level for men and women, it has become associated with Black culture and Black people. Mm-hmm. There have been transcendent African-American stars on the men's and women's side, but that doesn't mean that the game should have that association necessarily. And unfortunately, in the history of St. Louis, 1958, well, we should start in 1956, the St. Louis Hawks drafted Bill Russell. Now, the NBA had been integrated in 1950, but Bill Russell, immediately traded to the Celtics, goes on to win 11 championships in 13 years. He's an outspoken Black man. He's a civil rights leader of his own merits. He's at the I Have a Dream speech. He sort of goes to protests in Boston against segregated schools. I mean, this is a man who is both an elite athlete and truly a tour de force as an activist and intellectual. St. Louis's history suffers because of that trade. We traded for two white stars who helped the team to the 1958 NBA championship. That's the last all-white championship in NBA history, mm-hmm. the St. Louis Hawks in 1958. Every single championship won in the NBA since then has had at least one player of color on the team. And so this then manifests in St. Louis, insofar that basketball is associated with blackness, if you look at the city of St. Louis's website, they have a map of all the publicly available outdoor recreational basketball facilities, and it's pretty much maps perfectly onto a map of demographic divide, the Del Mar divide. Mm-hmm. Something like 21 of 30 basketball courts are north of Del Mar. So there's clearly been a strong association with city planners even that black people play basketball, and so we'll put basketball where they live and not where in neighborhoods that aren't majority
black. Right, right.
And that's a problem. It's a problem because basketball is joyous and wonderful, and it's a problem because it's a really problematic stereotype. So mm-hmm. whereas Hoops aimed to rectify that, starting with Forest Park, and we're so thrilled that the hoops were installed. July 9th, 2024 was mm-hmm. the first time
yeah.
that there were permanent hoops installed in Forest Park, and that's really a win for the region. But whereas Hoops isn't done, we've...
Yeah, what's next?
Yeah, my partner John Early and I should really call out John because he's the visual artist. He's the visionary behind the look of Whereas Hoops and all of the dynamic things we've done to draw attention to the issue of equity and sport and the basketball landscape. Our second phase involves getting grant monies to fix up some of the basketball courts, public courts that are in disrepair.
Mm-hmm.
Because Forest Park has a large budget because of Forest Park Forever, the nonprofit that backs it up. The courts
right.
in Forest Park will stay in pristine condition. I have
sure.
no doubt about that. But other courts around the city are not in great condition.
Mm-hmm.
The St. Louis Parks Department just doesn't have the money or staff to keep things up. And John and I care deeply about basketball and the basketball landscape. So phase two of our project will be to turn towards those other basketball courts around the city and try to make them more playable, better condition. Some of them don't have rims. Some of them don't have nets. There may not be court paintings. There are little things we can do to make these basketball landscapes more playable for the people who want to use them.
Mm-hmm. And in the courses that you teach at Washington University, how often do these systemic factors come up in the maybe some of the lived experiences or observations that are made by students? And I mean, what would having a WNBA team do to possibly change some of those discussions?
Yeah, I mean, I think WashU students on the whole are not often are very many of my students from St. Louis. So I teach a course with John called The Racialized Sporting Landscape of St. Louis. Athletics, aesthetics, bias, and opportunity. And part of the burden of that course is just educating students about the history of race and St. Louis,
mm-hmm.
and then focusing in more on sport. So we take them all over the city to look at different sites of sporting activity, but that also are interconnected with race and racism in the city. So, for example, we take them to the campus of Harris Stowe University, where Stars Park is located. It's still called Stars Park, but now it's a facility for Harris Stowe's men's baseball team to use. But it was previously, in the 1920s, the site of a Negro League baseball team that featured Cool Papa Bell, a
right,
legend
right.
of the game. And that edifice is long gone, you know, destroyed as part of the demolition of the Mill Creek Valley. So we talk about that demolition, and we take them to the Pillars of the Valley Monument at City Park, the soccer stadium where Damon Davis's piece stands to memorialize the Mill Creek Valley. So those are the kinds of things that we sort of emphasize to our WashU students about how different the landscape is, how sport has intersected with issues of race and racism, in how the landscape has been manifested, and asking them also to imagine different futures for the sporting mm-hmm. landscape of St. Louis. And having a WNBA team could be part of that different future. And I think one of the things that makes the WNBA such a fun league to follow and so hopeful is that players are activists. They really take a stand on issues that matter to them. Agree with them or not, they're not afraid to speak their mind. In part, that has to do with the way their salaries are suppressed. They have less to lose. But if you look at any of the recent protests, like in 2020 of the murder of George Floyd, the NBA players eventually spoke out, but the WNBA players were first.
Mm-hmm.
They're the ones really taking the lead on activism.
Noah Cohan is Assistant Director of American Culture Studies and co-creator of Whereas Hoops. Noah, thank you so much for joining us today.
What a pleasure. Thank you.
This episode was produced by Emily Woodbury.
Podcast design by Aaron Dorr.
Our executive producer is Alex Hoyer.
St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio. Understanding starts here.
Do you find yourself regularly listening to episodes of St. Louis on the Air? Suggest us to a friend you think might enjoy our conversations. And leave us a review and rating on Apple Podcasts on the App Store. It's the simplest way to help people discover our show. Thanks.
St. Louis Public Radio is a member-supported service of the University of Missouri St. Louis.
The Gateway brings you the day's news each weekday from around the St. Louis region and the state capitals in Jefferson City.
Our schools are accredited. We don't need this bill.
And Springfield.
How many more years must pass before lawmakers see time is of the essence?
I'm Abby Larico. Join me each weekday for The Gateway on the STLPR app or wherever you get podcasts.